Good morning, everybody. There was an author in America called Paul Miller. He does teaching seminars, but he would always start them in a particular way. He would write on a wee board behind him, usually a flipboard or someone along those lines, these words: I do nothing on my own. I can only do what I see my dad doing. He would then invite his audience to comment on what they think this person would be like from that one statement. A few answers that he would normally get fell into this sort of category. He sounds a bit weak. He's almost helpless. Does he actually have a mind of his own? Now, if this person's an adult, he needs a little separation from his dad. Has this actual person ever been given counselling? I think they might need it. Others said, it's not healthy. Some said, oh no, it's just very childlike. But the one that I particularly liked was, some people felt he was being codependent. Now, Mr. Miller, at this point, after he had gained all the things, would say, if you turn with me to John 5, verse 19, I'll introduce you to who said the statement. I tell you the truth. The Son can do nothing by himself. He can only do what he sees his Father doing, because whatever the Son, Father does, the Son also does. By myself, I can do nothing. Within this world, there is generally an approach which tells us to be independent thinkers. In other words, we're to follow our own star. Listen to what we believe in our conscience as to what's right and what's wrong. But as Christians, by total contrast, we're asked to do the total or complete opposite. What God is actually asking us to do as Christians is to be submissive to his will for our lives. Through Jesus, we see a life that was led submissively. And we know that as Christians, it is Jesus who we are meant to be copying, being, following. So today, I'm going to talk to us about submissiveness. And I want us to understand one aspect of this. This is the hardest thing for any Christian to do, because it's totally against every aspect of what we've been taught. We're not even seeing churches doing it. We see them standing in opposition to the authorities around them. Because when Jesus said that we were to be submissive, he didn't just mean that we were to obey God, but we were to obey the authority that has been put over us by God, which is human governments. Now, this is where we had a problem. We see in the world today many, many different peoples from all over the world protesting, shall we say, as to what they feel should be their legal rights. They are arguing with the government of their country, of their day. And when we see this in far-flung faces, we say, okay, well, we can understand why they have a hard time. It makes sense. But what happens when we see the exact same thing happening here? Because it does, regularly. We see people protest in many different ways. Let me give you an example from my own experience, which I came across a few years ago. It was very simple, and I nearly got caught up in it. Luckily, for myself, I didn't, but I'll explain why. There was a shift in the trust that I work for with their human rights policy, how they pay staff, what way everything works, and all the rest. So when they were bringing this in, a lot of staff felt a wee bit, they're changing things. It's not going to be to our best interest. We all need to be part of the union. We need to be sure that there's somebody batting our corner. And they went round everybody saying, are you in the union? You need to be in the union. Pressure. And they came to me. And they suggested to me that I should become a member of the union. To which I replied, I can't. It's against my religion. What sort of religion would you have that wouldn't let you join a union? It's just a religion that tells me that I have to be willing to work for my employer exactly as I would as if I was working for Jesus Christ. And if I join a union, and that union says, we're striking, then I can't do that. So therefore, by definition, I can't join a union. And they were quite taken back. I never got an invite to ever join a union again, by the way, so it worked. But that's the level of subtlety that's in some of these things. You see, we get tied in with what submission means to Christ. We need to understand that when he says to submit, he isn't making it a suggestion. He's making it a command. We are to submit to his authority, and he has given us into the hand of the authorities that we're in this world. And that's the hard bit, because we know they don't have our best interest at mind most of the time. But I want us to think, at this point to think about something that's very, very important. And one of the things I'm going to do is make sure I take off this watch, because I've got another wee clock. So I'm losing an idea of what time it is. But why I want us to think about this is, there is a consequence that is very important for us to take on board should we individually decide, well, you know, I want to do it my way. I want to follow my own star here and do what I want. And I want to share that consequence with you. It's in Matthew chapter 7, verses 21 to 23. And it basically reads this. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, and done many wonders in your name? And I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice, and in this version here, it's lawlessness. But some of you might have rebellion or transgression or a number of different other words there. But what does it mean? Well, you could put those who don't practice submission, because that's exactly the same meaning that can be taken from this. If you practice anything but submission to the authority of God in your life, you are practicing rebellion, because you're saying, I don't agree. Now, we might say, well, we're encouraged as children to express our own opinions, especially in school. I mean, it's getting quite remarkable how much modern education encourages young people to question the status quo around them. But what it's actually doing, and very subtly as well, is it's teaching them to think for themselves. This was a wonderful example of what was done in Genesis to Eve by a serpent. He suggested she should think for herself. He suggested, you know, well, I know God told you that, but you've been looking at this tree. I'm paraphrasing, by the way, in case you wonder where this is. You've been looking at this tree. You've been admiring the beauty of it. You love the scent that's been given off it. It's something that continually is calling you back to itself. Wouldn't you like a wee taste of it? You know it's going to be succulent. You know it's going to be beautiful. You know it's going to be the best taste you ever got. Did she know this? No. She had been told, if you eat of that tree, you will die. Or, to be more exact, dying, you will die. That was all she was told. So she knew there was a consequence if she ate this tree. She could eat of any of the rest of the trees in the garden, and believe me, their fruit were beautiful. Better than anything we've ever tasted. This is the reality of life. However, this 1-3 was always bringing her back. And it was suggested, as I said, that maybe she should try and test it. But she realized, of course, that this would be wrong. She said, no, no, no. God said. Remember, God said. She accepted the fact that the authority that was over her at that time, which was Adam and then God, God said that I'm not to take that. For if you eat of that, if I even touch it, I'm going to die. The serpent, of course, as we all were aware, suggested that maybe that wasn't 100% accurate. He suggested that maybe God was keeping something from her. And he told her what that thing was. He said, if you were to eat of this tree, you would be able to determine for yourself right and wrong. That's it. That's it. That's all this tree was going to do for her. Allow her to be able to decide what was right and what was wrong. The problem was, God said, the moment she took that thought, if we just take the tree away for a minute and look at the reality, once she entered into that form of thinking, once she began to think that she could make her own decisions, God said, you will die. Because we find that that creates lawlessness. And as we see in Matthew 7, lawlessness will have your relationship with Jesus resolved. You can't have one. You cannot walk in lawlessness and walk with Christ. When Jesus was teaching and preaching, his disciples accompanied him everywhere, and so usually did a large crowd of onlookers and all the rest. But he was heading towards Jerusalem, and he really wanted to go there. And as he was coming through a town of the Samaritans, they decided they didn't want to let him stay. Now, this upset some of his followers, especially two brothers, James and John. Now, we need to think what was happening here. James and John's view was, this is the Messiah. He has to be obeyed. He has all authority. We've seen him do miracles of miraculous aspect. We have not a doubt in our mind, this is who he is. And so when the Samaritans, who aren't Jews, must be understood, they're not Jews. And if we were using the actual correct definition of how James and John would have described them, we'd have to colour the language a little too much for our ears. Because that's how they thought about them. But here's the situation. Their response when the Samaritans refused to let Jesus in was, let us, give us authority now to call down fire from heaven and to totally wipe out this city. Now, I want you to think about this for a moment. This is something that we need to get into our head. Were they coming completely out of right field, so to speak? Was this unexpected? Or was there a preference for it? Was there an example that we could follow? Well, the answer is, of course, fire from heaven came from Elijah. He was allowed to bring fire from heaven and destroy the enemies that stood against him personally. Jesus is much more important than Elijah. So, of course, if they're standing against the authority of Christ, they should be destroyed. Plus, these towns are evil. They have to be able to just reject the Messiah. So, therefore, Sodom and Gomorrah were burnt with fire and brimstone. So, I mean, from the disciples' point of view, they felt this was legitimate. They felt this was justified. This was right. Rain down fire and brimstone on them. Destroy the entire place. Then they'll know the next time we say we want a wee bit of water and rest in our time, they'll not be so quick to say, close the gates. Jesus, on the other hand, literally said, whoa, stop it. Whoa, what spirit do you think you are coming from here? That's not what I do. I do not bring fire and brimstone down on people who say, basically, nah, we just don't want you today. That was very hard for them to understand, because their understanding of the Messiah was that that's exactly what he would do. He was going to bring justice into the nations for Israel and reestablish Israel. He was going to bring God's wrath onto people who weren't obeying him. So what Jesus is saying here to them is totally opposite to what they're expecting. It's a total difference. At this time, they hadn't fully comprehended that Jesus was going to actually be a sacrifice for the sins of the entire world. They didn't understand that his submissive nature to God was simple. It wasn't that Jesus couldn't have given them authority to bring fire from heaven down. He could. It wasn't that he isn't the king. He is. And it wasn't that he isn't the first and the last, for he is. It was that he was under submission to his father, who said, don't do it. Don't lose the head. Don't get yourself embroiled in any of their little petty disputes or arguments. Just walk a simple life, teaching the truth, healing the sick, casting out devils, and doing what is right. Give them an example of perfection. That's what Jesus was told he was to do as the Messiah. And for 3.5 years, that's exactly what he did. Now you might say, hang on a minute, didn't he get occasionally hot under the collar with some of them scribes and Pharisees? Yeah, but for a different reason. The scribes and Pharisees were the representatives of God, of his father's house. He had authority over them. So he told them basically exactly what it was that was their problem. But he wasn't involving himself in the political, cultural pressures of the day. He never said, oh, we should rebel against the Romans who hold this place. Instead, he said, give unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God. He separated, if you like, state and religion, where it could be separated. He told the people, if you are under authority and a Roman soldier comes to you and says, take my pack and walk a mile here with me with it. Jesus' response, now let's understand the Jewish response here was, if you do, make sure you do as much damage to it as possible. That was the Jewish response to it. Because they might be able to force you to do it, but you didn't have to do it willingly. Jesus, on the other hand, was saying, do it willingly. In fact, go over and above. Suggest that you'll carry an extra man. Think about the mindset of the people who are being oppressed, suddenly being told this is how they are to treat their enemy. And the Roman was, as far as they were concerned, the enemy. So Jesus' teaching is totally radical. Totally different from anything that's experienced before. Never has anyone seen anything as submissive. In fact, for all intent and purpose, we would look at Jesus as a liberal. We would say, he's wishy-washy, he doesn't actually stand behind anything. Because he doesn't stand up for himself. So here's a real problem as Christians that we have today. He wants us to be like him. He doesn't want us to make big stands. He doesn't want us to go along and have strong opinions. Every so often when I'm traveling around the place, I'll come into an area that is politically divided in a cultural setting here in Ireland. And you look around and you'll see flags. Alright, you get the usual tricolour, jack, all the rest of this, right? You get those. But you'll also get, occasionally, other countries' flags. And when you get the other countries' flags, it's interesting to see that you can tell who will have the Israeli flag up and who will have the Palestinian flag up. As you're driving through the different areas. Because it automatically tells you their mindset and how they think. One sees themselves as having a right to the country. It's ours. God give it to us. Nobody's taking it off us. The other says, we're oppressed people. We have been taken over. We're being pushed down. We should fight back with everything that we've got. And they look for support. Now, considering that within a Northern Ireland standpoint, these are supposed to be Christians who are doing this. Then you realize the problem, that they're not Christians, if we like to put it that way. They're not Christ-like in their approach, because they don't submit to his authority. Imagine if the churches in this land, just the churches of all the different denominations who claim to be Christian, obeyed Christ for 1 week. They wouldn't have an argument at all, anywhere. Nobody would fight or dispute or push their own cultural rights. Everyone would be submissive to each other in love of Christ. Not because the other is right, but because Christ asked them to. Not because the other had a stronger argument, but because Christ asked them to. And that's why it's so hard for us as Christians to understand that. Because while we are saved by the blood of Christ, while we are given the salvation and the hope of eternity, here is our problem. We're still very mortal. We're still very much in this world, and we're still very much influenced by everything that we see around us. But everything that we see around us is lies. It's designed by Satan to cause us problems. And you can pick and choose your fights, is what people would tell you. If you think you're going to win one, get on that side. But you won't win one, because you've been asked by God to yield. Now, if you've been asked by God to yield, how can you win? It's just a standard of practice. I want to give you an example. We often get into our head that a person who is submissive is weak. But let's imagine for a moment an imaginary figure like James Bond. 007. License to kill. Okay? He gets his orders. You're to go to this foreign land. You're to represent king and queen and country, or king and country, whatever it is at the moment. And you are not at any point to kill anyone, overtake any governments, blow anything up, drive any cars that you're on the speed limit, or anything else until your orders are renewed. But this is as a diplomatic mission that he's been sent on. So he goes to this country, and everybody recognizes who he is. And they all start to pick on him, and they try to kill him, and they try to do all these things against him, and he's not allowed to retaliate because he's under what? Orders. It's not that he wouldn't have the ability to do these things. He's not allowed. Would we say that the fictional character James Bond is a wuss? Weak? Would we? No. We'd call him a he-man. We call him, he's the sort of guy who gets things done. Yet every single one of us are under those same orders. Not to take on anything that's in this world, no one of its causes, to back off. Because we have one cause only, to submit our lives to Jesus Christ. And it's a full-time post. Therefore, if you're at work, it's right that you should work. That's a command from God as well. Those who can work should work. But if there's a union involved, you have to give yourself an honest answer. Can you work if the union says strike? If you've made a commitment to the union. Because your word's your bond. That's the other part that God tells you. If you've made a commitment to something, you have to do it. Peter foolishly made a commitment once. He was stopped by people who were collecting the tax from the temple. And they naturally said, "Does your master pay the tax from the temple?" Now, Peter's a good Jew. He knows everybody pays the tax from the temple. So, of course, my master pays the tax from the temple. Problem was, Peter didn't realize that Jesus didn't pay the tax for the temple because he didn't have to. There was different rules applied. So when Peter comes in, not realizing he had done anything stupid, Jesus says to him, "Who do the kings of this world demand tribute from?" Peter wondered what this is going to. Then Jesus confessed about it. Would they do it from the strangers that they have taken over, or from their own children, their own people? Now, this is tribute. Tribute, by definition, is when you have been taken over by a foreign power, or owned by a foreign power, and you have to pay them money in order to live in your own land. Tribute. So, Peter says, oh, it's always the foreign powers that take the tribute up, never their own children. And then Jesus explained that as sons of God, we are the children of God, and therefore any tribute that God demands does not have to be paid by us. It has to be paid by those who are not under his family authority. And so, immediately, Peter realizes his mistake. So what's Jesus going to do? Peter's, if you like, already committed it. It was wrong. But what Jesus did was quite remarkable. He says, we'll get Dad to pay it. We'll get him to give it to us so that we don't offend the Jews. We keep your word, and yet we don't disgrace ourselves by paying it ourselves out of our own resources. We'll get Dad to do it. So go away, down to the river, take a line, stick a hook on it, throw it in the water, pull up a fish, open its mouth, you'll find a gold coin, go and pay the temple tax for us. Now, Dad paid for it. That kept everybody right. Do you think Peter ever paid the temple tax again? Not after that. There's no way he ever was going to pay the temple tax again. Why do you make the story? Because we need to understand that people in this world have a responsibility towards God, and they will have to pay for that. But you, as the children of God, are inheritors of everything. You don't have the same level of taxes or things on you. But to be in children of God, you're subject to him. You have to allow him to rule you. That's where submission comes in. It's impossible to be a Christian and not live a submissive lifestyle. It's not as if this is not spoke about throughout the Bible. 2 Peter 2:18 says to servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear. Not only to the good and the gentle, in other words, the ones we like, but also to the harsh, the ones that pick on us, annoy us, irritate us, pay us too little. We're still to serve them as if we are serving Christ. Because this is why we were called. Because Jesus also suffered for us, leaving us as an example that we should follow his steps. You see, this is not our idea. It's his. So what things could we get involved in? Politics? Not allowed. What about getting into the legal system and becoming a judge or a solicitor or a barrister? Not allowed. You can't serve God and do that because you have to be responsible to the things of the law. What about if you were the civil servant? Subject to the government for whatever you want to do. Difficult, because the government have a right to determine what you do or what you don't do, to a degree. So you can't join the armed forces, you can't join the police. No, I'm not saying you can't. You have the right to do anything you like. But if you're submissive to Christ, it's impossible for you to be servant to masters. And the point is, if you join the army, for example, they might say to you, I think you should go to a battlefield. I think you should kill people on that battlefield. You might think God doesn't want me to do that. But guess who's going to win? If you've joined the army. How do you avoid it? You don't join the army. That way, your conscience is resolved. It's a problem. Yes, in some cases, it can be. But not always. We're to be submissive, and we're to make the decisions, and we're to bear the penalty when things go wrong. Do you know, in Israel, at Passover, especially at Passover, the amount of animals that were killed reached not just thousands, but tens of thousands, and some even estimate into the millions. That was young animals, a year old, being executed to cover the blood of the sins of the people. Now, why did this come to my mind? Well, I'll tell you why. Because those animals were under the subject or submissive to their shepherds. And the shepherds were submissive to the requirements of the people. So this was how it was done. Was this cruel? Big question. In one sense, it's very cruel. Until we find out who actually asked for this to start. Who said this should be done? And it was God. Would God condone the destruction of innocent life? Well, let's ask a question. What if a land becomes so vile, so evil, that it is literally going to impact on everything around it? Should God choose? Has he the right to deal with that? As a sovereign God, he has. It's his property. He can do as he wants. Sodom and Gomorrah are a result. But it wasn't just Sodom and Gomorrah. The entire peoples of Canaan were eliminated by Israel on command of God. And at one time, God even destroyed the entire earth. We always think, all them poor people. Well, no, let's look another way. The reason he saved two of every type of unclean animal and seven of every type of clean animal was because all of the rest of the animals were going to die in a flood. Everything died. Everything. God is in charge. But I want you to think of this. We can look now and say, well, we understand that. We understand why that happened. We can see how that was necessary. What about the Holocaust? World War II. What happened to the Jews? A remarkable thing was, in 1935, I think it all started. 32, 35, the whole thing was really starting to kick off. The Jews made a decision, right across the board, that they were not going to fight it. They were going to literally allow whatever was to happen to happen. Now, they believed that they were going to be taken and just moved somewhere else. It had happened for centuries. This had been going on. They just believed we're going to be moved away and taken out of the area that these people want for themselves, and we'll be given somewhere else. It'll not be as good, but we get used to it. But even when they realized that what was happening to them was they were being killed again, like sheep, at a sacrifice. That's why it's called the Holocaust, the complete burnt offering. They didn't see any hope. Nothing. They're asked their questions. Why did God allow that? What good could possibly come out of it? Do you know, some good did come out of it. Because if the Jews had have raised an army and started to fight and defend themselves, they possibly could have caused a complete change to the outcome of the war. But what they wouldn't have done would have made it possible for the mindset of the nations to change about them. So in order for them to be made acceptable to the world, they had to go through that suffering. They had to bear that disgrace, that loss of life. But as a result, they are now sitting back in Israel, where God wanted them to be all the time. There was a consequence for their actions There was a price that had to be paid, and there was a reward given to them at the end. We know these things. We can go through the entire course of history examining these things. So when I tell you that you are to be submissive, I mean you're to be as the little lambs that are being prepared for slaughter. That you are to be the ones who realize that you're going to be offended. You're going to be picked up. You're going to have hard problems in your life. You're going to be brought to the point of death. And some of you might even die. But Christ says, shh, don't speak a word. Don't offer a defense. Don't say anything to try and protect yourself. What you need will be given by the Spirit when it has to be said. Friends, we are at that time in human history where the things that God talks about to happen in the last days are already starting to spiral around us. Our safety, our time when we can meet safely in these places and not have to worry about persecution and problems are coming to an end. Maybe it might be a few years away yet, but we know that it's coming to an end. And what's going to be most notable about us is how we react when it happens. And to do that, we need to learn submission now. We have to divorce ourselves from everything that's in this world now and not allow it to influence us in any way whatsoever. We can't be influenced by alleged attacks of chemical weapons in other countries and wonder, oh, they had to do it, or they had to do it. It's not important. It's not important if the people decide to move a democratic country out of Egypt. Not important. It's not important if Russia and America lock horns together and destroy each other. Not important. The only thing that's important is that at the end of it, at the end of the trouble, at the end of the tribulation, at the end of the problems that are going to come into this world, Jesus Christ will return. That's all that's important. And you want him to be able to say, welcome, good and faithful servant. But how many? How many will hear Matthew 7, verse 21 to 23? It's not wrote to the non-believers. It's wrote to the believers. Because they said, we prophesied in your name. We cast out demons in your name. We done many wonders in your name. And he said, depart from me, because you weren't submissive. Thank you.